Alors, on est maintenant venu à l'entretien avec Shelia. Je veux dire deux mots sur le format avant de commencer l'entretien proprement dit. On va avoir une présentation d'environ 20 minutes qui sera suivie par un entretien de 10 minutes mené par moi-même et qui sera à son tour suivi par des questions du public. Mais dans tous les cas, n'hésitez pas à intervenir dans le chat pendant la présentation et pendant l'entretien. Je vous rappelle que l'entretien et la présentation seront enregistrés en audio. Donc, si vous ne souhaitez pas apparaître dans l'enregistrement, n'hésitez pas à intervenir dans le chat. Alors, je me présente très vite. Je m'appelle Lucia Pazzini et je suis doctorante en troisième année à la Sorbonne Nouvelle en Côte d'Italie avec l'Université de Turin en Italie. Ma thèse porte sur la mélodie française et la réception de la poésie française, enfin la réception musicale de la poésie française à la fin du 19e siècle. Et je voudrais tout d'abord remercier Shelia d'avoir accepté notre invitation à participer à ce colloque. Je vais le présenter. Donc, il est maître de conférence à City University of London, où il enseigne la théorie et l'analyse musicale. Il est membre du conseil de la revue Music Analysis et sa recherche associe l'analyse musicale aux enjeux historiques et critiques autour de la musique du 19e siècle. Elle porte plus en particulier sur Franz Liszt et parmi ses publications, nous citons Liszt Transcultural Modernism and the Hungarian Gypsy Tradition, paru aux presses de l'Université de Rochester en 2011 et lauréat du prix Alan Walker depuis 2014. Il travaille à présent sur une monographie dont le titre provisoire est Liszt's Late Styles. La présentation et l'entretien seront en anglais, mais je crois que poser des questions en français ne sera pas dans tous les cas un problème. Shay, I think we can start now, if that's okay with you. Please take it
Merci
away.
Beaucoup, Lucia, pour la gentille introduction. And I will continue in English before I embarrass myself any further. It's Shy Lawyer, by the way, it's pronounced Shy. I'm going to share screen with you and please tell me if you can see this. Okay, excellent. All right, so I'm going to start off by saying that we can divide very generally late style into a generic late style, which is simply about when styles start in an early phase and then they go into a later phase. So an early waltz in the early 19th century, a late waltz style in the late 19th century, etc. We can talk, when we talk about people composing, we can talk about several late styles. So again, they might take a particular style like the waltz or the minuet or a certain symphonic movement or a scherzo, whatever, and develop it further. So we're not talking about something particularly personal, but still more generic. But then there is the personal late style, the late style of a poet, the late style of a painter, the late style of a composer, a particular personal late style that is overarching. It involves all of these. Sorry, my cat has just seized my arm. Stop that. Right. Late style in the individual personal sense is a 19th century art history concept that evolved out of quite an ancient and long-standing discourse about artists in their old age. The idea of late style first grew out of German critical engagement with Goethe and Beethoven. It was invented to celebrate the last phase of creativity, of artistic genius. And genius, as we know, was a very big topic for 19th century aesthetics. Therefore, there is something in this concept that is overtly anti-ageist. It overturns traditional assumptions about cycles of growth and decay, namely that artistic creativity bursts in youth, matures in an artist's middle years, and then declines in the final years of life. But let's also note right from the start that this is a category that celebrates human exception, not the human condition. In fact, in many ways, it is mostly theorized as superhuman. A late style is a marker of almost supernatural genius, the ability to distill the essence of creativity from the past, bring a personal style to its extreme logical conclusion, and yet through this act of indomitable artistic will, somehow create something that intimates the future a long way before that future materializes. Late style is prophetic. Another seemingly non-ageist aspect of the concept late style is that even if it is about an overall personal artistic style, it can shift the focus to the artwork and away from associations with biology and psychology of old age. The precondition for such a category is that, in the first instance, a strong change from the artist's past style. Therefore, Spätstil in German is not necessarily Altersstil, old style. In fact, because it has become such a special badge of honor for creativity, especially in the wake of Theodor Adorno's influential aesthetic analysis of late Beethoven, there has been something of a late style inflation in the 20th century. Critics have rushed to discover late styles in the artist of their choice, irrespective of age. Shakespeare has long had a late style and he's in his 40s. And nowadays, even a composer like Schubert, who died at the age of 31, poor man, has a late style. However, late styles remain, in most cases, associated with old age. And in such contexts, stereotypes are deliberately deployed to augment a particular aesthetic appreciation or experience. I mentioned before the aspect of prophecy, and as we know, prophets speak the kind of truth that society rarely wants to hear, but which will eventually prove true. This aspect of rejected but ultimately vindicated truth, existing outside normal historical time, is central to the concept of lateness. It is forcefully projected onto the image of artists portrayed as too old to participate in or care about the discourse that shapes artistic trends in the present. They withdraw from mainstream society and the normal business of their profession. Sometimes illness and suffering is also thrown into this narrative. In that sense, such artists may seem to follow much of what awaits the ordinary elderly. But the important difference, as George Simmel wrote back in 1905, is that while old age nibbles senselessly away at the average and common man, it is the privilege of some great beings to be acted upon by nature according to a higher plan, so that even where she, nature, destroys, she uses destruction to extract the eternal out of the extraneous and disingenuous. Note that mixing the romantic cult of genius with older stereotypes of creative decay is only partially compatible with the more traditional romantic narrative of the triumph of the spirit over physical adversity, over the failing of the flesh. This is essentially a more modern aesthetic theory. Note also that when Simmel and others talk about man, they mean man, they don't mean woman. We can talk about this later. The last translated quote is taken from Sam Smile's excellent exploration of the origin and developments of the late style category. It is part of a whole edited volume entitled, sorry, Zoom doesn't like to show you that, Late Style and Its Discontents. This in itself, this book is part of the wider critical turn that might be termed late style skepticism. In some ways, I am also a late style skeptic. This does not mean a denial of profound stylistic change in late years, if that is something we can plainly read, see, or hear. It's more about questioning the categories used to explain such a perception of art, the ready-made myths and ideas of works that exist beyond their time in history, and the ways in which the final works of an artist are pathologized. This last aspect is the most relevant for this symposium, I think. Yet the best myths have a strong basis in reality. The question is which aspects of this reality is augmented and which is being suppressed to fit a particular story. Let's see how all this context applies to the composer whose music I've been writing about in the past 20 years. Franz Liszt's musical style has evolved radically from post-classical compositions in the 1820s to what we might consider proto-modernism in the 1880s. But with a composer so inextricably tied up with the cult of genius, it has never been a simple question of moving on with the times. Not for Liszt and not for those who posthumously theorized his work. The short piece, Nuage Gris, is often quoted to demonstrate this meaningful renunciation of current fashions in favor of a mysterious, almost mystical vision of the future. Let's hear the end of this piece. Excuse me, I will share a better sound with you. This is important. Here we go.
I have ADHD and it makes it, I'm not an auditory learner whatsoever.
No. And that's how it ends. It is like the opposite of romantic bombast or virtuosity. We hear short ascetic phrases, sparse musical texture, odd and static harmony instead of harmonic richness, a defiant dissonance that seeks to please absolutely no one. The unique dissonance and unresolved key have long been part of a story about Liszt arriving at the borders of atonality before any other composer did. In music history, a really important mark of prophetic genius. What is less obvious is that this and other pieces like it have been curated for decades to tell this story, as well as argue that these gray clouds are symptomatic of the old man's physical and mental state. If you go into late list, you will not be able to escape the way listening is also mediated by analytical and biographical literature. Like all myths, it is reinforced by countless retelling, not just in academia, but in books, article, concert notes, talks, and now text and videos scattered all over the internet. Where did this narrative come from? It is important to remember that in some respects, it originated with Liszt himself. He quite deliberately cultivated it with an eye on posterity. Ich kann warten, I can wait, he used to say, summing up, that's in German because he said it to his students in Weimar, he was bilingual, summing up the prophet's basic condition. He was aware of the idea of late style, not least due to the celebration of late Beethoven, which flourished 5 decades after that composer's death. He not only left tantalizing works that make an immediate musical statement, but verbal statements that reinforce the impression of a late style looking forward beyond the present. For example, he wrote on the title page of the Childish Macabre, "Can one write or listen to such a thing in two languages, in French, peut-on écrire ou écouter pareille chose?" Liszt champions followed the same route by demonstrating how Liszt was surrounded by people who could not understand music. The music he was effectively writing for future generations. And so we have the story in Cosima's diary of how Wagner thought Liszt was becoming demented in old age after hearing him improvise some of his latest music. And also the story from his pupil, Janos Weg, published in 1929, in which Weg reminisces how the childish macabre was born out of infantile defiance against an old arch enemy, the critic Eduard Hanslick. The idea there is that the composition was made chiefly to annoy Hanslick by being purposefully anti-academic. Well, Liszt might actually have said that. I wrote this to annoy Hanslick. Never mind all the artistry, the piece is basically a benign form of senile humor. By good luck, Weg writes, the manuscript remained a manuscript and the master failed to achieve his purpose. It was lucky not so much for Hanslick as for the reputation of the master as a composer, end quote. Oh, those beastly ageist, uncomprehending contemporaries. Terrible. But of course, these stories are told later, they're quoted later by more modern books, to make us feel good. We are on the side of the angels. We have the benefit of posthumous enlightenment. This partly explains why late style theories have been so persuasive. The story of Liszt's late style is partly a story of redemption. In the 1950s, the Liszt Society in the UK came out with a series of previously unpublished late works that create quite a sensation, especially against the rise of high modernism. Many analyses of the music emphasized its near atonality, followed along with stories about the vindication of Liszt's late music in modern time. These valorizing narratives persisted to this day, both music analysis and biography. I have called it Liszt's modernist rehabilitation, a discourse that relies on cherry-picking a small portion of the late repertoire, often contrasting it in an exaggerated way with everything Liszt wrote before, and directing our hearing away from the time the works were written, and often ignoring or downplaying the virtuoso aspects of Liszt late music. There is virtually no critical awareness of an engagement with lateness as a discourse in such literature. This is also why celebrating lateness, condemning contemporaries of Liszt, and exaggerating lists marginalization actually works to reinforce ageist stereotypes in a different way. Consider, for example, how virtuosity is often constructed as the opposite of the late style. So the early period, we have youth, health, athleticism, optimism. In old age, we have infirmity, resignation, pessimism. This is projected into the music. The early music is public, extrovert. The old one is private, introvert, retiring. The early one is earthly and physical. The old one is transcendent and metaphysical. The early one is musically insubstantial. The late one is musically profound, very deep. The early one emphasizes the performance event, and the late one is the work concept. It exists more in the abstract. There's a morally suspect early music and morally elevated. Popular early music and modernist, difficult, anti-generic late music. Mostly tonal music at the beginning and then post-tonal, strange, chromatic music at the end. Flamboyant, colorful, virtuosic music at the beginning, ascetic, gray, spare tack textures at the end, outside of time, ahead of its time. So you see, these are dichotomies that are used to define late style against something else. In other words, a valorized late style contains some of the most persistent stereotypes of what old age is about and project these into the music. Not only that, if you read some of the literature carefully, you will perceive more straightforward classical forms of ageism. For example, Walker's biography produces the same trope about Liszt's old age music manifesting disappointing depression and retirement from the world. And the music analyst James Baker simply accepts, still in 2005, that the lack of large-scale work in late Liszt is a testament to a decline in mental power, not simply an aesthetic choice, and despite all the evidence of inventiveness and productivity in Liszt's old age. And yet, this is not where I want to end my talk. It's too easy to simply seek out and condemn ageism wherever we see it. That in itself is not true criticism. Rather, a critical approach would be to recognize what stories have been told and the agendas behind the stories. For me, this critique is only a means to an end. The more positive object is to demythologize and recontextualize the music within its historical time. Furthermore, ageism should not be used as a big conceptual stick with which to beat down every single association between art and old age. That would be both absurd and anti-intellectual, I think. And I think there is a good question that should always remain open. How is a remarkable change of style associated with age after all? Of course, much of late style theory tried to answer this. The problem was not with the search for an answer, but the obligation to repeat the same tropes about the special condition of old age and about magical creativity. Can something more realistic replace this? A more frank and real meeting, perhaps, between professional gerontology and the humanities? I think so. But at the same time, sometimes it is also just useful to remember that the relationship between art and life is never simple or straightforward. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for this very, very interesting talk. Well, there's a lot that we can say. So maybe we can start from just one specific question that you mentioned a little bit, which is the issue with late style and women, or the absence of women where late style is concerned. This book that you mentioned before, Late Style and Its Discontents, only features one woman, Jane Austen, among the authors that it takes into consideration. And even then, it mostly says that there has not been a lot of appreciation for Jane Austen's late style up to this point. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that. And maybe I was wondering personally if this has to do with the fact that, as you said, late style kind of goes along in the 19th century with the concept of genius. And of course, genius is very much a man's condition, not a woman's condition in the 19th century.
Yeah, Lucia, I basically think you answered the question. It's exactly that aspect of the genius. If you think about the history of the concept and how it coalesced first around Goethe and Beethoven, those were the archetypical figures of the really highly elevated male genius. There was no question that, and the idea was to raise them to a level where previously, only monarchy and great leaders were discussed. So, whereas in those circumstances, it was a given that you will be ruled by a wise, older person. When it came to art history, the kind of default was a decline in mental powers. So the concept of a late style reversed this, but was deeply entrenched in the society of the time, which celebrated great men, absolutely. What's happening with late style now, from a feminist perspective, is interesting. I don't know the situation so much in literature, so you can tell me. So is it just Jane Austen that has been spoken about in these terms, or are there other female authors as well?
As much as I know, I've only heard about Jane Austen, and especially I think the presence of an essay about her in this book is very important, because this book kind of presented itself as a response to everything that has been written up until now on late style, on the Adorno, on the Said, on these very heavy contributions that have been made. I think we're kind of still, especially when we think about writers, not so much contemporary writers, but writers 19th, the 18th, the 17th century, we are still discovering women writers, and we're not there yet where we can say we're not yet discovering their late style, because we're still discovering them.
Yeah, I mean, that's true, and we are discovering women composers in the 19th century, even the 18th century and before, but mainly the 19th century, where there were simply more of them, but not yet celebrated and well known. And I think what's interesting about this is that the first step is to explore this music in general, or this literature. And usually the first instinct is to celebrate. These people have been suppressed, therefore we must celebrate them. And then the second thing that what might come here is that late style will follow, because late style is a strategy of elevating an artist. After all, it's a way of saying this artist is important, because only important artists have late styles. You know, if you just write music at the end of your life, that doesn't mean you have a late style. You only have a late style if a bunch of critics recognize that what you've written late in life is really important and different from anything else, because of reasons X, Y, and Z. So if you can rehabilitate an unknown composer, or you can elevate women composers who've been invisible in history so far, or minorities that have been invisible so far. If you add late style to this mix, you're really evoking a 19th century category that immediately elevates that composer even further. But here is the problem. We're already at a stage that there is a critical turn in understanding late style as, you know, this kind of critical strategy of doing that. So we can't be naive and, if you see what I mean, we can't be naive about doing that anymore.
Yeah, absolutely. Or
at least we won't be naive for a long time. That's coming.
Yeah, I guess this begs the question on the other side of the specificity of the artistic production in old age. And if there is a specificity, and if this peculiarity is there, how do we talk about it if the late style category has become suspicious and brings with it all of this baggage, this critical baggage?
Well, I'll start by saying that it's suspicious, of course, because late style can be really condensed and sparse and minimalistic, but it can also be the opposite. It can be monumental and over the top in terms of the resources used. And then the explanation is that it's pushed beyond the limits, etc. You know, there are ways of explaining these things that create this kind of mythologizing aesthetic analysis. There's a good article by Joseph Strauss from 2008. I forget the title of the article, but basically what Strauss did is that he did a kind of survey of writings on late style, and he showed how there are commonalities in some categories, but then commonalities in other categories. But the problem is that some categories are complete opposites as well. So late style is so flexible that if you want to break it into stylistic markers, it's not really difficult to do. You can choose the one that fits your story.
Yeah, and this is very clear in this book, Late Style and Its Discontents. It's made very, very clear by the essays. I would like to just mention what Justina just put in the chat, that we call ourselves a journal of young researchers, and we talk about emerging artists. And of course, these are categories that can be, can be brought into a relationship with the late style category as, you know, in the way that we use them as a strategy to make ourselves more visible. Also because I guess, you know, with late style too, maybe these are immediately intelligible categories when we talk about them. There's not a lot of critical depth that goes into them. They're immediately associated with, yeah, certain stereotypes, but of course we can, I guess, weaponize them.
But we can also, what's been particular about late style as a concept that came from the 19th century. Once again, it's important to remember its relationship to the cult of genius, is that a late style is not late unless it somehow transcends its historical time. It can't really belong to the fashions of that particular time, or it needs to twist them in a really meaningful way. And of course that is related back to the genius who just won't participate in the normal discourse and gets into an extreme corner, even exile, being kind of a spiritual exile from his society, and it's always his society. If you talk about the feminist side of things, it was easier for to critique and see men as non-conforming than women. It was far more difficult, especially in the 19th century, to talk about non-conforming women in a respectable way, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, I have, of course, a ton more questions, but I think I will leave the floor to Anne-Claire.
Okay.
Thank you, Lucia. Thank you for your communication. It does echo with what we see in literature of the 19th century. And I am very interested into receptions of artwork. And I was wondering if you had thought about the horizon of expectations of the critics. And I guess my question is it, for example, the same critic that says that this style of lit at the beginning of his production is early style and then later on is late style? Or is it different groups and communities of critics that also move along with time and look at the artwork with a different maybe expectation? I think there's something there. I was wondering if you had thought about it or
I'll give you a good example of how late style was weaponized and kind of a little controversy around Liszt late style. So in the Cold War years, after the Second World War, there was a kind of a critical split between the East and the West that was weaponized even in the arts. And one of the things, one of the differences that were really noticeable in Liszt reception and the reception of late style in particular is that most of the Liszt champions in the West were also in some ways modernists and in many ways belong to, were connected with Darmstadt and with 12-tone composition after Schoenberg, etc. So they were looking for these things in Liszt's music and they found them. They found, you know, hints of this is going this way. And for them, these were the most valuable works. Late style is also about selection. It's about selecting something from the repertoire to demonstrate this is late style. So it always involves some kind of selection. So they selected certain works, which you will still see today demonstrating these things to show Liszt as this kind of prophetic genius modernist who foresaw what was coming in the 20th century. And of course, what was coming in the 20th century was them, their music, what they cared about, the aesthetic that they cared about, right? So that way, late style can be appropriated to advance an aesthetic agenda in the present, a critical agenda that is also ideological at times, an aesthetic. In Hungary, the situation was different because what those critics were very, very concerned about is to show how Hungarian Liszt was. And so they took the late style as a demonstration of a deepening of the Hungarian idiom in the music and a creation of a new East European kind of modernism. There's a book called The Twilight of Ferenc Liszt by Benczeszabocsi from 1859, which has these a little bit post-Marxist ideas and about society and how the late style was predicting that, and also how Liszt was predicting specifically the greatest hero of Hungarian composition in the 20th century, Béla Bartók. And he shows all of this. And again, it involves some kind of cherry picking. So how Liszt was received in Hungarian academia and outside is different in quite significant ways around the time that these late compositions were being discovered and republished again after the Second World War. So it was also a question of timing, as well as the political constellation around that that time. So late style was definitely involved in and implicated in reception. And I just gave you one example. I hope that was clear.
Yeah. And so my question, I guess, is could we say that late style is more a concept that says more about the critics and the way they interpret things rather than Litt's works itself? I mean, isn't the concept actually useful to study the critics rather than the musician? Or would you say there is actually something there about Litt's work itself?
So I think both are possible, actually. It certainly says a lot about the critics. And the more specific it is, the more it says about the critic. But we shouldn't lose sight as analysts, whether we're literary analysts or music analysts, we really shouldn't lose sight that if the music is significantly different, we have to ask questions like, is the difference because everything else was changing? And partly the answer is yes to that. And this is where late style is being mythical by too much disassociating a composer or an author, an artist from the time they lived in. We have to ask, are categories being used because they already exist and then they are superimposed on this particular composer? There's superimposed theory that says more about the theory than the composer. We always have to judge these things, right? We always have to consider that this is a possibility. At the same time, if there is something unique and extraordinary, we shouldn't ignore that. We can't. I don't subscribe to the idea that everything is just a critical construct. If you can perceive that there is something extraordinarily different in works from the last 5 years of a composer's life, you have to ask what is it. But I wouldn't start with all the categories of the. Or I'll put it this way. I am aware of all the categories of the late style, but I wouldn't rush to just project them on that music. I would keep questioning them. And as I said at the end of my talk, I don't think there is enough research about, serious gerontology, serious scientific study of old age in relation to artworks. All these late style theoretical developments happened in the humanities, and they're all based on aesthetic ideas and not a lot of scientific understanding of old age, actually.
I think Anna-Claire's question really went straight to the point, I mean, to the tension between the critical constructs that of course do originate in the actual works, but then kind of leave them and exist in a sort of, I guess, bubble that is detached from the productions. And then when you try to bring them back to the productions, there are tensions because the actual works are always unique and they always escape the generalizations that we make to understand them, but I guess we have to make them. Otherwise, we're lost, I suppose.
I agree, but the bad side of that coin is you read Late Style and its discontents. I mean, I think it was in the chapter of Sam Smiles where he says, I went into the museum of a Picasso exhibition and it was arranged according to periods. And before I got to the last room where the last paintings of Picasso were exhibited, I knew exactly how they're going to be represented. And I wasn't disappointed. he knew exactly the language that would be used to describe the childlike simplicity, the simple lines, And This is not to say that Picasso doesn't use simple lines in his final works, etc. But what does it mean, and why do we pathologize it and call it childlike simplicity?
Yeah, absolutely.
That there is an aesthetic there that could be dealt with in a different way.
Yes, of course. And yeah, what you were saying about the need for more scientifically sound works and understanding old age is, you know, it's very true. I mean, the biological change in old age is undeniable, and also the cognitive change is undeniable up to a certain extent. It's not the same for everyone, but then again, yes, these things do need to be taken into consideration. And I think we're out of time. So I would like to thank you. And I have more questions that I might email to you.
I'm happy for you to share my email with everyone here if anyone didn't get a chance to ask a question and had a question.
Yeah, I will do that right now. I will put it in the chat. There we go. So I would like to thank you again very much. And I also would like to apologize for mispronouncing your name. I am so sorry.
Merci beaucoup. Thank you for the invitation and having me.